So, to introduce the next section of Tanya, chapter one, towards the end. Now, we're going to get into the meat of, I think, what is the most powerful teaching of the entire book of Tanya. There was a story happened that the previous Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak, he was the sixth out of the seven Rebbes of Chabad. So he was a great-great-grandchild of the Alter Rebbe who wrote Tanya. He was traveling through Germany. This was in the 20s. And he was sitting in a hotel lobby with a local rabbi, a German rabbi, who was a scholar but was not Hasidic and had not studied Hasidic philosophy. He wasn't familiar with it. And here he was sitting with a Hasidic leader. And he asked an interesting question. He said, "I don't understand. Chassidus, this Hasidic philosophy, is it something new or is it a part of the Torah that's always been there? If it's new, then it's not the Torah. And if it is a part of the Torah, then it's not new. So what is it? I don't understand. What's this Hasidic philosophy? Like this revolution. Well, if it's a revolution, then it's something new. But if it's new, then it's not the Torah. It's a different movement. But if it is part of the Torah, so it's always been there, so then what's new about it? What's revolutionary about it?" That was his question. So sitting there in the hotel lobby, the previous Rebbe pointed to the corner piece on towards the ceiling of the lobby. There was a very intricate, beautiful carving that went all along the, what do you call this?
Cornice.
Cornice, yeah. That's the word. So he pointed and he said to his guest, "Did you see the beautiful, intricate cornice there? That decorative, sculptured cornice. Did you notice that?" And he looked up and he said, "No, I didn't notice. It's beautiful." And so the Rebbe said to him, "It was always there, you know. Just you didn't notice it." And that was the answer to his question. That Hasidic philosophy takes ideas that were from the Torah, from the writings from earlier, from the Tanakh, the Talmud, the Zohar, the Midrashim, the what's called the written Torah, the oral Torah, everything's all there. It's all got sources before. But ideas that people didn't really notice till now, or they didn't put the same emphasis on. And Chassidus will take it, bring out the light in it, point out the intricacy of it, bring it alive, and that's the newness of Chassidus. It's not a new philosophy, it's part of Torah. But it's a part of Torah that wasn't always emphasized, it wasn't always noticed. So the Alter Rebbe in writing Tanya, on the one hand, he was a new soul bringing a really new message to the world. But everything he says, he has sources for in Torah. Sources that were known, but maybe not noticed. And the next idea is probably the central idea of the book of Tanya. In answering all the questions which we've looked at the last couple of weeks about a tzaddik and a benini and what these levels really mean. So he says to understand all of this and to understand what's going on inside of us and to understand ourselves properly, we need to know one thing. And that is the next part of Tanya. It is on the final page of the sheets that we have. The explanation of the questions raised above. That is what we're up to. So, what does the Tanya say? Let's read a few lines. The explanation of the questions raised above is to be found in the light of what Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote in Shar HaKadusha and in Eitz Chaim, portal 50, chapter 20.
Hello.
That in every Jew, whether righteous or wicked, are two souls. As it is written, the neshamot, the souls which I have made, alluding to two souls from the book of Isaiah. Okay, what's he's quoting here Rabbi Chaim Vital, who was the leading student of the Arizal, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. The Arizal was the great Kabbalist of Tzfat, northern Israel, in the 1500s. He only lived there for 2 years, by the way. He taught and lived in Tzfat for 2 years of his life. He passed away at age 38, I believe it was. And those 2 years, he revolutionized Judaism and brought Kabbalah to the world. Much of what we do is based on Arizal's teachings and those of his students. Just in those 2 years, he wrote down nothing. It was written down by his student, Rabbi Chaim Vital, and other students. And so what's called the Kitvei Arizal, the writings of the Arizal, he didn't write, his student wrote. Rabbi Chaim Vital is the primary redactor of his teachings. So Rabbi Chaim Vital has a book called Shara Kedusha, of Kabbalistic work, of teachings, and Eitz Chaim, which is teachings of his teacher, the Arizal. And in both of those works, he quotes an idea that every Jew has two souls. And this idea is going to be the central idea of Tanya and something that we need to get our heads around over and over on a deeper and deeper level. That we have two souls. You thought you had one, you have two. And two doesn't mean two souls like a previous life in this lifetime. Right now, right here, as we sit here, there are two souls that are beating under the surface of our consciousness. We have two entire personalities. He's going to go through them, but in general, these two souls are called in the writings of the Arizal and here in Tanya, the Nefesh Elokit, the divine soul, and the Nefesh Bahamit, the animal soul. These are the two souls, the animal soul and the divine soul. And we're going to meet them at length and in great detail as we go along. But by way of introduction, these two souls are similar to, in many philosophies and in previous Jewish writings, there's the idea that we have a good side to us and a not so good side to us. We have different sides to our personality. We have our better side and our lower side, not such good side. That's something that's common to many philosophies. Yeah, and
the yin and the yang.
Correct, yeah. That's found in many places. There's something a bit different. The idea of Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara is found in the Gemara, that we have an evil inclination and a good inclination. We have a voice inside of us tempting us to evil, and there's a voice inside telling us, no, you've got to do the right thing, a good conscience. Correct. Here, it's a bit different to that. What the Alter Rebbe is introducing here, based on the writings of Rabbi Chaim Vital and Arizal, is a bit different to the Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara. The idea of a good and bad voice is there's me, I'm me, and I have different sides, different voices, different influences to me. The two souls is different. The two souls is I have two me's. There are two personas within me. There are two entire souls inside of me. Not just a voice, but a soul. What is a soul? A soul is a personality. I have two complete personalities in one body.
Is this for every person or every Jew?
This is a Jew, and he's describing the structure of the Jewish soul. And we'll see as he goes along the difference. I have two distinct personalities. One of them is divine, one of them is animalistic. Divine meaning upright, altruistic, righteous, holy. Animalistic meaning selfish, instinctive, just survival, and therefore willing to do that which is wrong as well, and that which is immoral. These are two distinct souls, not voices, but souls, which means that I have two sides to my very self. Now that is very different to having two different voices like on your shoulder whispering into your ear. It means that at any one time, one of these souls is my identity, is myself, is what I'm involved in, and the other one is trying to get in. And as really what Tanya describes is the eternal battle between these two souls, battling over our life. Let's get to know these souls better and try and feel them, try and identify them, and see how they work inside of us.
Was he, Rav Chaim Vital, was he also a student of the Gaon Mivilna?
No, he was before. He was before, yes. Rav Chaim Vital was a student of the Arizal, which is, and that's 200 years before the Gaon Mivilna, and before the Alter Rebbe.
Because it's similar to the concept of, like I read time ago, Chaim Vilojin, Rav Chaim Vilozhin, and his concept also, you know, is Yeshiva is Etz Chaim, same as the.
So the Vilna Gaon and the Rav Chaim Vilozhin, who was his student, they were also they were avid learners. They studied the works of the Arizal and based many of their teachings on the Arizal as well, just like Rav Chaim Vital. Okay, so let's meet the first soul. The first soul that he introduces to us is, surprisingly, the animal soul. He starts with the animal soul, not with the divine soul, with the lower soul, not the higher one. And we'll see why. There's one soul, he continues, which originates in the Klippa and Sitra Achra. Klippa and Sitra Achra are two Kabbalistic terms for evil and for negative. Klippa means the shell, like shell of a fruit. And Sitra Achra is Aramaic for the other side. The other side. So one of our souls, its source, it originates in Klippa, which is the shell, the husk, or Sitra Achra, the other side. The husk is a term for evil, because really the essence of evil is that which covers over good. Like a shell covers over the fruit. You see a fruit on a tree, but you don't see the fruit. You see the shell that's covering the fruit, the husk, the peel that's around it, that's covering the fruit. To get to the fruit, you have to break through the shell, the peel.
But the shell also protects.
That's right. The shell is a part of the fruit. It's a part of the divine creation of the fruit. If it weren't for the shell, the fruit would not be able to develop and become ripe and ready. So it's a necessary part of the fruit, but the only way to get to the fruit is to break the shell. In a similar way, evil exists in the world. Evil is not something that comes from somewhere else, it comes from Hashem. God created all, including evil. Evil is that which covers over goodness. There's goodness inside, but it's covered over by a facade, a shell. And you need to break through that to get to the goodness. But evil is necessary for good to exist. Like a shell is necessary for the fruit to develop. You can't have goodness without evil. It wouldn't make sense. There wouldn't be the possibility of doing good if there wasn't the possibility of doing evil.
So it has to be evil if we
have good. For good to have any meaning, there has to be its opposite. For there to be good deeds, there has to be the possibility to not do good deeds, but you chose to do good deeds. Otherwise, it's not a good deed, it's a deed. Like, there's all there is. The creation of evil was a necessary evil. Because you can't have good otherwise. And not only that, but it even protects the good, meaning it allows the good to have real power. Because when you've overcome evil to do good, that good is really good. If we were pre-programmed to do good, well, what's the big deal? If that was the only option, so then...
It's like if we're always happy.
Right, then what's happiness? Doesn't have any meaning. There can't be light without darkness, and there can't be happiness without sadness, and there can't be good without evil. It doesn't mean that we want evil. Evil is there to serve a purpose, which is to be overcome to get to the good.
Evil can't be overcome. And a good thing.
Correct. That's bad news. So that's why we believe evil can always be overcome. And that also is indicated in the second name of evil that's used here, Sitra Achra, which means the other side. It's the flip side. It's the other side. It's the contrast. There's goodness, and then there's the other thing.
By definition?
Yeah. Which means that all evil is the other thing. Evil was not created because God wanted evil. Evil was created because God wanted good. But for good to exist, there has to be the contrast of it. There has to be the other thing. And if we would avoid evil and do good, so then it would remain just Sitra Achra, the other thing. The path not taken. The way you don't go. The shul you don't go to. No, the place that you avoid, right? That's all it is. It's the thing that you don't do. That's all it's there for. The problem is when you do evil, when we make the wrong choice, we give evil power. We give it attention. We make it into not just the other thing. It's a real thing now. If Adam and Eve in the garden didn't eat from the fruit, so then they'd just be good. They'd just be good in the world and the thing you don't do, which they didn't do. So that'd be it. It could be they realized that would be a bit of a pointless life, and so they ate from the fruit because we've got to tackle this evil thing. But that's a topic for another time, where the depth of Adam and Eve and their sin. But in theory, at the beginning of creation, there was goodness and like the thing you don't do. That's all evil was, the thing you don't do. And as long as we don't do it, that's all it is. Sitra achra, it's the other thing, the other side. When we do it, we give it strength. So, he calls it, he gives two names to evil here, klipa and the sitra achra, and this is the source of the first soul, which is the animal soul. This is where our one soul comes from. It comes from that which covers over holiness and goodness. It's the cover-up of holiness. It's the part of us that avoids doing the right thing, that goes for superficiality rather than depth and truth. If it looks good, it's good. And I'm happy to go for it. It's the part of us that can fall and leads us astray. So he continues in the description of this soul. It's from Klipa and Sitra Achra, and which is clothed in the blood of a human being, giving life to the body. We know in our body there's the circulation of our blood that goes through the body to give it life. The heart is pumping blood through the body to enliven, to energize every limb and organ, every part of our body. That life force pumping through us is our animal soul. Which is a bit surprising. We're introduced to this soul as being the sitra achra, this evil klipa, evil thing. And then we're told, and it gives life to your body. Most references to soul in our culture, when we say the soul, is the thing that enlivens our body. Like the batteries that give energy to our physical self, to our body. And here we say, well, yeah, that's true, but which soul that is? That's the animal soul from Klipa and Sitra Achra. It gives you life. It gives you energy. It's the blood flowing through your body. The reason why he identifies it as being the blood circulation is because this soul is a spiritual entity, but it's enlivening your physical body. And the blood circulation has a bit of a spiritual element to it. The warmth and the energy of the blood flow has a bit of a spiritual sense to it. It's physical, blood is physical, but it's got a warmth to it. It's got an energy, which is a bit spiritual. And so that blood is the house where, or the vehicle through which the soul enlivens the body. So our instinct to survive, to be alive, our hunger and thirst, our need for rest, our physical needs are all energized by this soul, the animal soul. Now, what's so bad about that? What's so klipa and sitra achra about that? Being alive? Sounds good. We need that. It's a positive thing, it would seem. But the baseline, the axiom of being alive is being a separate entity from God. There's me. I am an ego. I'm a self. I'm an entity. Seeing ourselves as separate from God is already the source, the beginning of klipa. Not seeing ourselves for who we really are, which is a part of the divine reality. Seeing ourselves as separate is the source of evil. And so, therefore, what the Alter Rebbe here is really introducing is the very concept of ego. That I am a thing, that ego, this is the animal soul.
Wait, there are two different things. So there is the natural world that you're defining, that is the bestial instinct of us, that is the the blood flow, etc., the more materialistic. And then there is what you call, you describe as the spiritual thing, right? But the spiritual thing, that world is, we arrive to it through education. And we arrive to it through education. So how can a bestial soul, like a person that is raw, become that spiritual elevated being without that education? How can one that is living in a void get that education? It's not something that...
Well, you're talking already about the other soul, the divine soul, which is our higher self. Here, this soul is the thing that enlivens our body. As we sit here right now, we feel alive. We are aware of our life. More than that, we're aware of our self. We have self-consciousness. We are wondering, do I fit into this group? Are people looking at me? Am I acting strange? Do I stand out? That's my self-consciousness. I don't know what you're thinking. I just know what I'm thinking. So it's me, my self-awareness. I look at the food on the table, and I'm a bit hungry. It's not really hungry. You don't eat this when you're hungry. It's just a desire. I'll feel good if I eat this. What's good for me? Is this good for me? Am I in a place that's good for me? Do I feel comfortable here? Do I feel safe? Am I threatened?
That's the bestial side.
Yes, this is all the animal soul. This is all the animal soul, but it's giving me life. It's enlivening my body. Mm. It's energizing my body. It's a soul. It's not a physical thing. It's a soul.
You said a starting position is evil.
Sorry?
Our starting position is evil.
Well, we've only spoken about one soul. Yeah. There's another side. There's another side to us. But the level that we're most conscious of is selfish. And selfish will lead, if we stay in that selfish mode, to evil. Because if I'm selfish, it's at your expense. And if I have to hurt you for my own good, I'll do that.
So that's what we're starting from.
Well, the reason why he's saying this one first is because we're born with this first. That the animal soul, immediately at birth, is there and asserts itself. And so a baby, as soon as the baby is born, feels its hunger and its cold and what it wants. It already has desires and wants for itself immediately on birth. The divine soul that we're going to meet in the next chapter, which is our higher self, our elevated self, the divine part of ourself, which is the soul in its deeper sense of a soul. So that is there at birth, starts to reveal itself at the bris for a boy, at birth for a girl.
But it develops over time.
And that at bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah, then it really settles in and starts asserting itself. It's only at bar or bat mitzvah that the divine soul has a real voice inside of us. Until then, we have an animal soul, an instinctive self, and hopefully the parents step in and guide that animal soul in the right direction.
Okay, so it requires a facilitation of an external entity to bring the being, the human being, into the right course.
Well, the divine soul comes, yes, but for us to not just follow our instincts, yes. We need to be educated. We need to be guided. We need to be inspired to do that. Because to live like an animal doesn't need education, yeah. Right? An animal has instincts, and from birth,
and the instinct
they follow it.
Pleasing. You have the food.
Correct.
You want to just dive into it. It's
right.
Nice.
So human being can live exactly like that. And this is why it's called an animal soul, is because animals don't do anything wrong. Animals do exactly what they're programmed to do. They follow their instincts. An animal does not hurt in a way that is cruel or vicious. It just does what it's programmed to do. If that means eating you up and attacking you, that's it. If it's protecting itself or it's young or it's hungry or it feels threatened, it's just programmed to do that. Nothing personal. It's not an evil intention. Animals just do that. And also, animals don't do an act of kindness and altruism other than what it's programmed to do. for survival, for protection, to look after its young, to look after its owner or its master. Okay, that's its instinct. It follows its instinct. That is what an animal does. You can manipulate those instincts. You can train it to do this or that, but it's all through, you know, giving the rewards and the chocolates or the associations. It's just got to follow its instinct. And that's how an animal lives. In the case of an animal, it's not considered good or evil what it does, because it's an animal. That's it. In the case of a human being, we can also live that way. A human being can also live purely instinctively, following my urges. Just doing what feels good for me, what I like. And then you're also living like an animal. But for a human, that's a problem. Because we can be better than that.
But I also think that with you, and when you live like that, you're actually going downhill. You can't just stay like that. It's actually, you know, if an animal lives like an animal, if you take a dog and just leave them in the wild, they'll become a dog. They'll be a dog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But if you take a human and you just let him do whatever he wants, mm-hmm. he'll become actually, I think, quite...
quite not bad. A pleasant path at all.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And that's because a human has higher elements. And if those higher elements are not developed, so then they become an accessory to the instinctive.
The evil.
And that's even worse.
Do they always come from like a nefesh or a kiss? Or is it always from that divine soul? If your nefesh abam is the animal soul, if you are in a place of goodness, or is it coming from your animal soul, so it comes to that entity still?
So we're going to see here at the end of this chapter towards that even goodness could come from the animal soul.
Okay.
If it's instinctive. If you're just following your instinct, there were people who were naturally nice as well. We do all naturally in our personality have goodness and nice parts of ourselves. And if we do things purely instinctively, and just follow our nature and our character without working on ourselves, without trying to improve ourselves and refine ourselves. So you could be a nice person, an animalistic person. There are nice animals as well. And that's good, but it's not ultimately good, because if I'm just being nice because that's my nature, when my nature tells me to be rotten, I'll be rotten and I'll be cruel because I'm just following my nature. Whereas if my goodness comes from a higher purpose, not from just my instinct, because this is the right thing to do, whether I feel like it or not.
Decision.
Then I'll do good even against my nature, and that's real goodness. That's where the divine soul comes in, where it's not about me. It's not about my ego and my feeling and my instinct. It's about what's really right. So you could put it like this, that the animal soul does what's good for it, whereas the divine soul does what's good. What is good? What's truly good?
Ego only in the animalistic form.
Yeah, yeah. And like everything in the animal, which we'll see, everything can be transformed, can be elevated, can be used for holy purposes, can become a partner with the divine soul, even ego. Even ego has a place here. But when ego is in charge, when it's just about ego, so then it's all about me. And everybody else is a threat to me. Because everyone's in my way. Like my ego, there's no room for anybody else. So unless you're serving my ego, you're a threat. If you're not on my side, then you're with us or against us. And that's where a lot of human clashes and problems happen. It all starts with the ego. So...
But also, good things come from the ego. When you have competition, when you try to improve yourself and become better than someone else, and it brings the best out of you.
Yeah.
Often.
Yeah. So there is an idea that says kinat sofrim tarbe chachma, that jealousy amongst scholars will bring more wisdom into the world. I want to be smarter than you, so I'll be. You know, that's certainly true. That is utilizing ego for a higher purpose.
So
but if it's one-upmanship, if it's all about just me being better than you, then it's not ultimately good. It's just me, you know, it's just that competitiveness. But you can use that. You can say, like, I look at somebody else at their achievements and I'm jealous, not that I want them not to have the achievement, but I want to reach that as well. Depends what you're jealous of. So that's an example of utilizing ego for a positive purpose. But we've got to be careful with that. Whenever we're using ego, it's a dangerous tool as well. So says the Alter Rebbe in this paragraph that this is the ally force, our animal soul, the first soul, is the soul that comes from Klipa and Sitra, comes from evil source, that which covers over godliness. It's me and not God. And it is our life force. It gives us existence. And so my instincts, my preservation, the fact that I'm hungry is because I need to live. I want to live, and that's a good thing. I need that. So we need this soul. Without it, we wouldn't eat. And we wouldn't survive. We need that. We need to have some sense of self. God created us with this. He gave us this. But there's dangers to it, which we've got to look out for. As he says, from it stem all the evil characteristics deriving from the four evil elements which are contained in it, which we're going to list now. So our negative characteristics, the part of our personality that is lowly and evil, come from this animal soul, and specifically from the four elements of the animal soul. This is an idea that's found in other philosophies as well, and in Greek philosophy and others, where the world is made up of four elements, which are fire, water, wind, and earth. They are the four elements. And so some philosophies talk about the physical world being made up of these four elements, and that everything is a combination of fire, water, air, and earth. In scientific terms, you could identify it as, you know, gases and liquids, solids, and heat, I guess, is fire. Here, the Alter Rebbe is using this in a more mystical, a metaphysical sense, that every experience in the world, not just every physical entity is made up of these four, but every experience, every entity, every spiritual matter is made up of four different elements, four different levels of it. There's the fire element, the water element, the air element, and the earth element. Fire is passionate, hot. Water is cool and calm. And air is very spiritual, earth is very physical. All experiences, everything can be divided into these four things, and each personality can be divided into these four things. And here we're going to see how the animal soul has these four elements to it, which are the source of the various different type of negative character traits that we have and we struggle with. And what are they? The next paragraph. These are anger and pride, which emanate from the element of fire, the nature of which is to rise upwards. Okay, let's analyze that. That anger and pride, or arrogance, come from fire, the element of fire. Well, anger, I guess, is pretty easy to identify with fire. We rage with anger.
Proud, we're often taught to be proud of our achievements or the things we do.
Yep. So there's a difference between being proud and pride, having pride, or here, in Hebrew, it's the word gaiva. Gaiva means more arrogance.
One step beyond.
Yeah. Being proud of what you've done is one thing. Being arrogant about it is a little bit different. Why would arrogance be from fire? So he says the nature of fire is to rise upwards. It lifts itself upwards. Fire always flickers upwards. You look at a candle, it's always going up, fire, jumping up. So too, we have a part of ourselves that is lifting ourselves up. What you said before about the competition, it's that, why should he be on top? I want to be better. I want to be on top. Why should that person get all the attention? I want to get all the attention. This is coming from arrogance. This is this pushing yourself up. And anger and arrogance are actually twin brothers, because we only get angry because we are arrogant. if you think about it. That I'm angry at you.
It's not going my way.
Because you said something that I didn't like. Or you insulted me. Or you disagreed with me. So I'm angry at you. If you could imagine a person who had no arrogance whatsoever, who was just completely egoless, just not about themselves at all, it's impossible for that person to get angry.
We read that God got angry.
Okay. It's a good question.
It's a healthy anger.
And Moses got angry, and there's place for anger. Place, yes, for that's true.
Healthy anger.
But that's a very controlled anger.
Also,
it's like, should you get angry at your kids?
Yeah. It's a question how manifests itself. How anger manifests itself. It manifests itself in words or shouting or violence.
In the said, just the face show them like you get angry.
Right. So there's an effective anger,
yeah,
which is where you're indignant. Somebody has done something that they need to be taught or straightened. You know that they've done the wrong thing. And you need to react.
Like a robber in your house, or if someone says something to your wife, whatever, there's like a, it sort of triggers a nervous system response.
Right. The anger that is more familiar and not so productive is the anger that we're not in control. We lose control at that time. And we rage, and we say things that we then regret, and do things we regret, and we can't believe we did it. But we couldn't help ourselves at that moment. And that anger is not productive. It doesn't teach any good lessons. It only creates resentment and further negativity. That's the type of anger we're talking about here. When God gets angry, it's not like he's out of control. It's that your actions matter to me. And when you do the wrong thing, it brings negativity into the world. That's God's anger. When Moses got angry, That's what he was doing. He said, I'm a teacher. I'm responsible for these people. And we know very well when we're doing that anger or the other one. If you can, you know, in a moment of anger, and that the initial feeling of anger, we it's hard to control that. But do we express that anger in words and deeds, or do we hold on for a minute? Say, okay, what's the right, you know, mode of action at the moment, and then in a very calculated way we present ourselves, and it could be with an angry face or with a stern voice, but it's controlled. So then that's not egotistical anger. That is, I want the best for this person. I'm responsible to teach them, to inspire them, to direct them in the right way. That's not egotistical anger. But that anger, the more common anger, is what he's talking about here, and that is where we lose it. And we only lose it because me, you're going against me, you're not listening to me. That comes from arrogance. And if we think about most of the times when we get angry, if we would stop and think about the situation, it's pretty unreasonable. I mean, getting angry at kids, for sure. No, like, it's a kid. Do they know? You know? Do they know better? Like, they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, is acting like a kid and misbehaving. My job is to calmly direct them that's the wrong thing.
So anger in that moment is actually not the right approach.
Yeah, that's just like me feeling I'm not being respected and listened to. That's my arrogance. And so too with all negative forms of anger. So arrogance and anger come together. They're the element of fire. It's me saying, how can you not listen to me?
Why is it important to allocate certain characteristics to an element? Why can't characteristics just by themselves?
Well, I think because we want to get to know these characteristics. We're not just listing our bad traits. You know, we're actually trying to identify them and get to know them better. If I know where it comes from, I'll be able to deal with it better. So now I know that anger is from fire. What's the nature of fire? If you have a fire in your house, a fireplace or a candle or a fire, so what do you need to do? You need to make sure that it is contained. That a fire needs contained. Fires spread. They spread very quickly, and they consume everything, they eat everything up and destroy. And so if I don't have control over that fire, I'm in trouble. So now I know that my anger is a fire. I have an element of fire in my soul. And if I don't control that fire, it will eat me up. And it will destroy others as well. That's the nature of fire. So now I know that when the early signs of anger come on, I need to hold that fire back. Otherwise, it's going to go out and burn and destroy. And same with arrogance. That the arrogance is going to lift and lift and get bigger and bigger. So the more we identify, the more we are familiar with their source, the more we can work on it. Okay, that's where my anger is. Continues, the appetite for pleasures. This is like a hedonism he's talking about here, like indulgence. That whether it be food or shopping or just our need for constant pleasure, to be feeling good in a self-feeding type of way. Our phone addiction is also part of that. It's just like the thrill, needing a thrill and needing to feel good. Yeah. So where does that appetite for constant pleasure come from? It's from the element of water. For water makes to grow all kinds of enjoyment. So this one, it's a bit more subtle than the fire one. That water is moisture. A dry place, there's no pleasure in it. A watery place there is. Like the difference between a desert and a rainforest. A desert, there's nothing growing. It's empty space. A rainforest, there's trees and fruits and life happening. The difference is water. That's the difference between the desert and the rainforest is just water. Water irrigates all the pleasures of the world, all the beauties of the world. A dry person, someone who's very dry, what do we mean by that? No sense of humor. Yeah, there's no, in Yiddish the word geschmack, like a bit of pleasure, you know, there's no, a dry person, there's nothing pleasurable. You know, someone who just gives the facts, you know, the dry facts, like, but there's no pleasure there. In Hebrew, lachluchit is moisture. And in Hasidic terminology, lachluchit means someone who has a bit of life to them, energy and, you know, pleasure to them. So water is the source of pleasure.
How does it relate to ritual hand cleaning and stuff like that? The water, a lot of rituals involve water, things like that. Is there a relationship there?
Not specifically here, because here we're talking about the animal soul and the water and the animal soul. But of course, every element we utilize in our mitzvahs in various different ways. And water has the power of purification and elevation. But here we're talking about, in its negative sense, it's pleasure seeking. It's the need for constant pleasure. Now, again, there's nothing innately bad about pleasure, but when that becomes our life pursuit, so then where does it stop? Because it means that if something's not fun and not pleasurable, I don't want it. I'm not willing to do things that go against my grain, because it's not pleasurable for me. And to live a moral life means I'll do the hard things as well. I'll do it even if it's not fun for me, because that's what you got to do. It's the right thing to do. We live in a very hedonistic society. I mean, it's we're bombarded with so many images. Yeah, the whole advertising industry is about telling you this pleasure is what you need and you deserve it and it's here for you and you got to go for this. So we're constantly bombarded with these things. I'm missing out. I've got to have this. And that creates a loop of like just needing more and more and living a life of just pleasure seeking, because that's the nature of pleasure, there's a saying in the Hasidic writings, tanug tmidi eno tanug. A constant pleasure is not a pleasure. A pleasure that you have all the time is not pleasurable anymore. You need a new one. Once you've got it, it's no fun anymore. You need the next one.
It's a type of addiction.
Mm-hmm.
When you're addicted to something, the levels of serotonin in your brain become higher and higher, and you want more of that. It's a good feeling that you become used to.
Correct. Correct. So maybe that's also why it's compared to water. It just keeps flowing and flowing and flowing, and it never stops.
And also why the advertising industry is effective is because they're tapping into that psychological weakness, temptation, the ability to distract.
That's right. Even when it's not working, we still pick up our phone thinking there's going to be the next pleasure and the next good news and things that we need to see.
There are two different types of pleasure. There is the pleasure that you can get enough of, that once you get it, it lasts very quickly, and then you need to seek the next one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pleasure that comes out of creation. When you create something, you invest your time, you invest your effort, you make something new out of nothing,
right.
And then that pleasure is an achievement. It's not just a pleasure.
Correct.
If it's delayed.
So I would give that a different word. I would say that's more fulfillment.
Maybe.
Than pleasure. It's satisfaction.
It lasts for a long amount of time.
Yeah.
And it's like you set your food out.
And all of these traits can be used for positive. The thing is, there's instant pleasures, and then there's a more long-term, deeper type of pleasure.
But they're also not talking about, correct me if I'm wrong, the avoidance of pleasure. In and of itself, that's not what it's saying. It's not saying you must avoid it. It's saying you must not indulge.
You have to be a master of it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the animal soul just wants you to go after pleasure and pleasure and pleasure, and that's it. Whereas the elevation of the animal soul, the elevation of this pleasure is that saying that, well, pleasure has a purpose. We don't do anything without pleasure. We don't make a move without pleasure being a driving force. But there's in Hebrew there's a word tanug, which is often translated as pleasure, but here it's talking about ta'ava, which is more the desire in pleasure. Tanug means a certain self-satisfaction, like a deep sense of satisfaction. Tava is an urge, much more of pleasure. So there's the pleasure of doing something good. When you know you have had a meaningful day and you've contributed to somebody else's life, you've brought joy to another person, that's also pleasurable. That's not the same pleasure as checking your phone or eating a cinnamon babka cake.
And it's interesting, when you do something good for someone and they say thank you, the thing to say is, it's my pleasure.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it need not be self-serving.
Yep.
You can still get pleasure out of other things.
Yes.
But it may not be pleasurable to you to do something which satisfies somebody else.
As long as one person in that equation.
I mean, if you accept to think that well, you're doing the right thing, but at the time...
100%. You should do it anyway. We should do the right thing, pleasure or not. What I'm suggesting is that there is a deep satisfaction in looking and saying that I have actually brought some goodness to another person. And I think if at the end of every day, we can identify some good that we've brought to the world, then there's a deeper pleasure. It's not fun, it's not a thrill, but it's a deeper version of pleasure. Whereas here we're talking about just self-serving, pleasure-seeking. That's the animal soul. And again, we can spend our life on that and spend our life thinking that that's what life is about. It's not fun, I'm not having fun, this is not pleasurable, so then there's not a good life. There are other things, there are higher things. He continues, frivolity and scoffing, boasting and idle talk from the element of air.
It's a lot, isn't it?
Yes. Frivolity and scoffing.
What is frivolity?
To be frivolous. Is
what?
To be frivolous.
Is letzanut.
Okay.
To make fun, to make light, to be dismissive of things.
To be cheeky.
So it doesn't mean he's having a sense of humor. That's a very Jewish thing, and that can be very holy as well. Here it means making light of things that are serious. Scoffing to scoff at something. You know, like somebody says, you know, a serious thing, and you go, ah, what you're talking about? You know, like you just dismiss it. Whenever you know someone makes a good point, and you know you can always make a joke, and then like everyone laughs at it, and it's lost.
When you say that, this is idle talk. You talk about gossiping, or is that what
it's... So idle talk means just a time wasting type of thing. Just completely time wasting. We're not even talking about lashon hara, evil talk. Just completely empty, meaningless, time wasting. It's something we can very much relate to today. Like time flies by. We feel like we're doing very important things, checking very important things on our various devices, and hours go by of nothing at all that is in any way productive or helping anyone.
Like talking to women.
The Mishnah says, no, "Well, that's for another time. We can discuss that one." But yeah, we're very very busy today with nothing much, you know, like hours and hours go by where that could be productive. Now again, everybody needs relaxation and unwinding and downtime, and you know we all need that, but for meaningful life there's a part of that. But then what about our relationships that we need to invest in and be connecting with, and what about the meaningful learning that we can be doing and things that are actually uplifting? So if we would like put, you know, portion out the day, so we all need a bit of the unwinding. But the idle talk, I think, is a broad category of massive time wasting, and that's air. It's the element of air. It's empty. There's nothing there. So all of these things, frivolity and scoffing, means that you're just dismissing serious things, making air out of it, making light of things. So and we do this also internally. That when we get a bit inspired by something, you know, a bit moved by something, whatever, you know, like don't take it so seriously. We take the air out of it. We lose the inspiration. Sometimes we do it to ourselves, sometimes we do it to others.
Yeah, it's two sides to it.
Yeah, or someone does it to us. You know, you're like you were getting serious and getting inspired by something. Ooh, yeah, you know, like a bit of a joke, bit of make fun of it, and it's gone. When you make fun of something, you don't have to counter it. You don't have to argue against it. You just that one good joke, and it's gone. Yeah. You've dismissed it.
So if you find that you're doing something that it is one of those elements, let's say like either the air or the water, or you find yourself in like looking for indulgement, so will the contact with water, physical contact with water, will be the... Like, will counter it or will make it worse?
It's an interesting question. I don't think that the physical contact in and of itself is going to make a difference, but it could be the contemplation that you have. The thought that you have in, you know, like having a cold shower, you know, or you know, standing by the fire and contemplating it, that can certainly help. No, thanks. Whether the physical thing itself, I don't know.
Will you try and next week let us know?
I will.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretzels.
In the meantime, have the pretzels.
Water, fire,
whiskey.
Ah, we saw it. Yeah, we put water and fire in there.
Now, I don't know if you picked up in the list of the air. elements, the air characteristics. There's one there that doesn't fit in so well, the frivolity and scoffing air, making it light of things. Boasting. Boasting seems to connect to arrogance and pride. Now, that we said is fire, and boasting was talking how big I am, how great I am. Why is that air as opposed to fire? Isn't that the same thing as the arrogance? There must be two different versions of it. There's a fire version and an air version. So fire, we said, the nature of fire is to lift itself up, right? That's arrogance, right? Boasting is also like puffing. You puff yourself up. But puffery is different to fire. It's empty. Fire. It's empty. There's an arrogance that has some substance to it, a fire. And then there's the boasting, which is actually empty. I can look at my achievements and become arrogant because of my achievements. I have really achieved these things, but I didn't have to become arrogant. I became arrogant out of it. I said, look at me, look what I've done. But it's based on something. Now, what I should be doing is saying, look what I've done. These are the amazing opportunities that Hashem gave me, the amazing gifts that Hashem gave me, and be thankful for my achievements, not arrogant about it. Like we mentioned last week with Moses and his humility. If somebody else was given these opportunities, they would have done a better job. I'm no better than somebody else, but I'm proud. I can be proud of what I've done, but not arrogant, because these are the gifts that Hashem has given to me. That's when I look at what I've done. But then there's, well, I haven't done anything. And to compensate for that, I need to puff myself up as if I'm this amazing person because of the emptiness that I have inside, that I actually haven't done anything and I haven't done anything good. That's a different demon.
I was going to say, I've read a few LinkedIn profiles.
All in
that category.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So instead of having the humility to say, I haven't done anything, but there's a lot that I can do. You know, like I don't have to become a nobody or feel down about myself because of my lack of achievement, and probably also. My feel of lack of achievement is also not so true, because I could probably recognize the things I have done, but at the moment I'm feeling my emptiness, and that emptiness is causing me to need to puff myself up.
It's almost like the emptiness that you speak of. It's like an insecurity in the armor of the ego.
Correct.
And these things fill it in,
mm-hmm.
to like patch it up.
Yep. So that's coming from the element of air. And finally, the fourth element, sloth, which means laziness. And melancholy, or feeling depressed, come from the element of earth. Earth, out of the four elements, is the heaviest. It's nice physical, dirt, land, earth. And so this heaviness is expressed in laziness and depression. That's two versions of heaviness. Laziness is, I just can't be bothered moving. Inertia. Which is my element of earth, pulls me down. I just cannot be bothered. Depression is an emotional version of that, where I can't be moved.
Feel heavy.
Yeah. My heart has become stone, desensitized. I can't feel. Now, and of course, there are clinical versions of this, and we're not talking about that. Here it's talking about the type of depression that everyone goes through on varying levels, which is where we just feel down and not energized, not motivated. And we do have control over. We're not talking about a depression that you have no control over. That's a different discussion. Here we're talking about more an attitudinal thing, where we feel down and we start to have a cycle of self deprecating thoughts of how low I am and how useless I am.
Can you explain that definition between those two types of depressions? How can it be, like, what is distinguishing between them?
It's really hard to distinguish because they there is a lot of overlap. I'm just being cautious that there's depression that is hereditary. There's depression that is a chemical imbalance.
Yeah. Or it lasts for 6 months or longer.
And correct. Yeah. But within that, there's also depressive thoughts and thought patterns and attitudes that could cause that or could worsen that situation. And so it's not like, somebody who's in deep depression, we can't go up to them and say, it's your animal soul, it's change your attitude. It's not so simple.
So you're saying it's chronical, so mm-hmm. it came from... Basically, the animal side kind of took over for too long, and now it becomes more.
It could be that, or it could be other causes. It's not necessarily coming from a person's bad choices. A person could go into depression.
Yeah. I'm not trying to find sense. Mm. So medically, you talk about either chemical depression, genetic depression, or you've got a reactive depression. Mm. It's a circumstantial. And that's how you react to what's happening in your life. So
right.
You're talking about the reactive side, not yes. the
chemical side. They're the words. Yep. So
you're depressed because you cannot act to things that are happening in your life. You don't have the willpower to basically act on different things.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if it's coming from your animal soul, when these things are coming from... your disappointment in life, you were expecting better, or you wanted better things to happen. I'm not happy with what's happening in my life. And that lack of happiness and complaining and looking at the negative and, so you're creating this sort of negative cycle inside of you, which takes you further down and down and down. That's something that you have some control over. You have a say in. And that's coming from that... the same source as laziness, in a way, just not being alive.
It sounds like it's lack of correlation between your expectations and your level in reality.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Two different.
Yep. Levels. And interestingly, we can look around at people who have gone through really difficult stuff and are not necessarily depressed.
You made different choices.
And other people who haven't necessarily gone through that type of stuff, but managed to find things to be upset about, and always have something to complain about. This guy really could be complaining about his life, and he's not. He has such a great attitude, and this person, what are they complaining about already? And because you're constantly kvetching and complaining and finding the negative. You have a miserable life. That's what we're talking about. That's the depression that we're talking about. That's
pessimistic.
Correct. And that brings you down and makes you weaker. It's the element of earth.
The glass half empty.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So here we see the four elements of the animal soul. And let's go for another couple of minutes. From this soul stem also the good characteristics which are found in the innate nature of all Israel, such as mercy and benevolence. Your animal soul also has some innate, natural, good traits. We're talking about instincts here. So there's a certain mercy and benevolence, but mercy is a sense of kindness. Benevolence to do good. We naturally want to do good for other people. We naturally have a sense of mercy and compassion. We all have that to some extent as well. But when it's instinctive, it's still your animal soul. It's just your nature. There's nothing bad about that. There's nothing bad about being compassionate in an instinctive way. The problem is that you'll only do it when you're in the mood of that, when you feel like it. Not when you're not in the mood, because that's not your instinct.
But this is strange. all the other ones that you just mentioned, they're also negative traits and also positive traits we discussed. But the writing brings only the negative traits. This is the only one, the earth, in which it brings...
No, it's not. This is not about earth. This is not talking about earth specifically. This is saying from this soul, from the animal soul...
Yeah,
from the element, although full stop. From this soul, which means the animal soul, stem also the good characteristics. We've finished with the discussion of the bad characteristics. We also have good characteristics from our animal soul. So it's not all bad. And he says this because the Jewish soul, the animal soul, comes from what's called klipat noga, which means a klipa. It's a covering, but it's got some light in it. It's got some goodness.
Is all klipa noga?
No. There's two types of klipa. There's one called klipat noga, which means klipa, but it has some redeeming features in it. It could go either way. It could be taken either way. And then there's what's called shalosh klipot atmeyot, the three absolute unclean klipot, which means they have no redeeming feature whatsoever. And he says that the souls of the nations of the world come from those klipot.
From the unclean.
Yeah. Which means, and this is very controversial, this is in the first chapter of Tanya, he says that the gift of the Jewish soul is that we have this divine soul and an animal soul that can work with it. The nations of the world aren't given that. We need to bring that light to them, the light of morality and goodness that has to be brought to them, because they weren't given it. And so this doesn't mean that the souls of non-Jews are all bad. There are righteous Gentiles. A righteous Gentile also has a klipat noga type of soul, a soul that can take in the goodness. But what they don't have is the divine soul, which we're going to talk about in the next chapter, which is the ability to bring the divine light into the world. We have to be the messengers of that. That's the Jewish mission.
So you can receive the Jewish soul, basically, if someone converts.
Correct.
They're not born with it. They receive it.
They receive it, 100%. It's not a racial or ethnic thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a soul thing. And if someone wants this or someone feels an affinity to that, they can get one. But that's not necessarily their mission.
Mm.
So... In other words, in the first chapter of Tanya, he already wants to tell us, we have to understand that the Jewish soul is different. It has a different makeup. It has a different mission. It's much more complicated. You know the saying that says the Jews are like everybody else, just more so. So it's very true. Jews, we're more complicated. We have this animal soul and a divine soul. We have two souls. The nations of the world have one. They have one soul. And they also have a spark of godliness. They're also divine creatures. They're also created in the image of God. But the Jewish soul has this dichotomy, this tension, where we have the animal soul and the divine soul. There's two things going on. And that's why we're the messengers of God for the whole world. It's always been that way. We didn't choose that. We were chosen. Because we have the divine soul, which we're going to meet, please God, in detail next week.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Now we start the week with a strong spine, strong energy.
Mm-hmm.